Welcome back to another exciting episode of Behind the Paddle, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of pickleball and the athletes and figures who make it thrilling. I'm your host, Rob Nunnery, and today we have a special guest who's taken pro pickle by storm over the last couple of years. Joining us today is none other than James Ignatowicz. Since turning pro in 2022, James has won numerous titles on the PPA Tour and has also claimed an MLP championship. And this episode will get an inside look at James's career, his life before pickleball, and some of the heavy challenges he's faced on a personal level. And we'll go deep into his thoughts on the future of what pickleball looks like on the amateur side and the pro side. So sit back, relax, and let's get into it with pro pickleball player James Ignatowicz. Welcome to Behind the Paddle.
We are Selkirk. We are pickleball.
Pickleball?
Yeah, pickleball.
All ages, family, friends, dinks, drives, Ernie's, ATPs, and whatever this is. 10 years in and just getting started. Here and not going anywhere. We are you, and you are who we work for. Family owned, USA made, pickleball proud. Selkirk Sport. We are pickleball.
James Ignatowicz, we are good to see you, man. It's been a while since I've actually seen you, which is a little sad, but you know, at least we could do this. I wish we were sitting down in person recording this, and maybe we will be able to in the future. But welcome, dude.
Welcome to the this episode of the James Ignatowicz guest appearance. This is it. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be on the other side of it, man.
Dude, I haven't done a guest appearance in like, I don't even know. I mean, Jordan Briones had me on his podcast, and it hasn't been released ever. So I don't know. It must have been
still
bad.
Not.
No, it's still not up there. You could try to find. Well, actually, by the time this is uploaded, maybe you will. But I haven't done a guest appearance in a long time, so that could be a sign. I don't know. That's all.
Maybe it's requiring just extremely heavy editing.
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah, it probably is.
But you know, based on some of the things you say and some of your responses, it's certainly possible that it's just he's combing through the hour interview and it's heavily redacted. But this is going to be a little different, dude, because we're going to go, you know, obviously, you have a podcast that goes into a lot of how to get better at pickleball tips. We're gonna turn the page a little bit and go a little bit more into the personal side of things and a little bit of your journey from growing up playing junior tennis up through your time at Vandy and now into being one of the best pickleball players in the world and kind of the journey that you took to get there. So. And I think you first, I don't know, I don't want to say first came on the scene, but it was because you were obviously, you know, very good at this point and you had won a couple of events last year in Minneapolis. But just to kick this episode off, you know, you had the whole Big Papa Jimmy thing, the monkey's off my back. It was just like these off the wall, ridiculous quotes that, you know, kind of, I don't want to say put you on the map, but people are like, oh, finally, we've got an actual personality in pickleball, which has been lacking for a very long time. And like actual personality in terms of, you know, just being lighthearted and funny. And obviously we've had good personalities, you know, Tyson, guys like that. But I, you know, in preparation for the show, I found a couple of other it tidbits or interview quotes from James Ignatowicz in the past that I think lend itself to the fact that this isn't your first rodeo, and we're going to take it all the way back to, I don't know how old you were. You must have been, I think you were 12 or 13.
Yep. I know where this is going.
And this is actually from the East Hampton Star newspaper. And you were interviewed after a tennis tournament where you had a couple upsets, and they were pretty easy upsets. but let's see the direct quote here. Okay, so the East Hampton Star says, when asked how the match with the top-seeded player had gone, James said with some delight, he thought it would be easy. I went up 3-0, mixing it up, slicing, lobbing, and hitting it hard at times. I was in the zone. He wasn't that strong mentally. He started throwing his racket and screaming. And he cried at the end. I love the "and" he cried at the end. And then you go on to, for another quote that says, well, the East Hampton Star says it was more of the same in the final. Quote, since he was a lefty, I floated the ball to his backhand and I'd run in and hit overheads. He cried too. That same kid beat me 6-3, 6-0 6 months ago before I even came here. So I just love the fact that in two different quotes in this article, you had to talk about how the kid cried.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that I remember that, and a bunch of people have already, you know, like a lot of my friends have seen that and brought that up with me. I really don't remember. I think it was like a tournament in the Hamptons, and all of the kids in the Hamptons. So I actually lived in the Hamptons. My parents always had a house there, and then I lived there for about a year and a half when I was 13. And the Hamptons is like a really nice area. All the kids are really spoiled, including me. But those kids were particularly spoiled. And especially, you know, if you get a 14-year-old kid from the Hamptons, they're not going to be mentally tough on the tennis court, especially when they're playing against somebody as annoying as me. So I think that's what happened. I was definitely annoying at that age. I called the lines tight, and I was making kids cry. So yeah, that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned kind of the entitlement aspect, which I don't think is super unusual, like you said, for kids growing up in wealthy families or from the Hamptons. What do you think? What do you think led you to not having that? I guess that as much of an entitled attitude as some of the other kids that, you know, you grew up around.
Yeah, for sure. That's a really good question, actually. I think that it's funny because you look at my sister and she actually does have it. So maybe I'm just special. But no, I'm just kidding. Well, I mean, I think that for the most part, like I wasn't put into tennis. My parents never played tennis. They didn't like, you know, force me to play tennis or anything. Like, I wasn't one of those kids. And they just signed me up for tennis when I was like 5 or 6. And I just started playing and just fell in love with it on my own, just genuinely. And that's pretty different. I think a lot of college tennis players have parents who played and parents who kind of maybe not forced them in, but, you know. So I think that was one of the different things. It was like I was genuinely in love with it, and it was something that I wanted to do just for me. And I think having that sense of like just agency throughout the process, you know, having something that I deeply care about my whole life, I think that definitely helps build character, because if your parents are forcing you to play it and then you lose a match and then you're upset because you made your parents disappointed, that's one thing. But if you're 9 years old and you disappoint yourself, right, that's actually a great way to build character. And I also think that one of the reasons I think I don't have the, I mean, I would hope that I don't have the entitlement aspect. I mean, some people might not agree, but I don't think I feel that way, because I've found that the only times that I've, well, this is a little bit of a longer answer, but so I went to Vandy, and like I had a couple years where I wasn't even on the tennis team at Vandy, and I had like the easiest life ever. Like, I was in a fraternity, I was drinking a lot and like going out and partying and having a ton of like of fun. And at that time, I was trying to make my life as like easy as possible. Like, my focus was like, I'm just going to have fun and things are going to be easy. And, you know, my parents paid for my college. My parents had which is actually interesting, because I was on a scholarship at first, and then I was no longer on the tennis team, and then they still paid for my college, which was very nice of them, because they could have said, look, man, now it's your time to pay for it. They paid for it, and they were always super supportive of me. I really didn't have that many challenges. And I, for whatever reason, found that even though everything was super easy, I literally had their like credit card to spend, and I didn't work, and I didn't really try that hard in school, I wasn't happy, which is interesting because like I had everything that I could have thought I wanted. I was like, wow, my life should be so amazing. I just go out and I do a little studying, do a little bit of studying, but more cheating in class, really not doing all of the right things. And I was like, well, this isn't, I'm not happy at all. And I thought I was supposed to be happy, but I just didn't feel happy. And I actually was just, I felt like really empty and just not good. I just didn't feel good at all. And then I found that, you know, the times where I felt happy were actually when I was working very hard. And it was weird. I found that like the harder I worked and the more that I pushed myself and the more I actually like really inflicted like suffering on myself, like I really went out and did like hard workouts, got really focused on pickleball, and now I'm teaching like 20 hours a week and I don't even need to be. A big part of why I do that is because I found that like I'm at my happiest and I feel the most fulfilled when I'm just working hard and really pushing myself. So it's a weird thing. Yeah, it didn't come from anybody else. Like my parents didn't really instill hard work in me that much. They kind of did, but it kind of came from me. So
yeah, and was like as a kid, for example, were you always like, let's call it with tennis or academics? Because I did see that you had a, even though you, maybe you were partying and stuff at Vandy, you still had pretty high grades and good marks. With the work ethic stuff, you know, growing up, did that, was that like an inherent thing that you just had, or did you see your parents doing it? Because it doesn't sound like it was really like forced upon you in terms of instilling work ethic. So where did that come from?
Yeah, it wasn't really forced on me. And I actually, I didn't really work that hard until 2 years ago. I had good grades at Vandy, but I didn't reach my potential in tennis at all. It was weird. Like I worked pretty hard in tennis, but I kind of fell out of love with tennis when I was like 16. I just got to the point where I sort of regretted being homeschooled, and I still sort of do regret being homeschooled during high school. I think that one of my biggest regrets is that I never went to real high school, and I think that would have been fun. And I think it also would have not just been fun, but I think it would have set me up socially to be more prepared for college.
In what sense do you think high school would have done that?
I think just with making friends, I think just being homeschooled is tough. If you're homeschooled from the age of 13 on, you're not really, I don't know, like I had some social anxiety. I just had some like nervousness around other kids because I didn't have more than like 3 or 4 friends when I was in high school. So I just was not really comfortable in big groups. And I felt like all those kids were smarter than me, which they were, right? They went to Vandy and I had just gotten in off of tennis. So I just felt like, you know, I was like, I'm just like, I just got in because I played tennis and these kids are all like smart and stuff. And like, I was afraid I would say something dumb, which then will actually end up making you say something dumb, you know, the more you're afraid of saying it. So it was weird. And I think that if I had gone to like a good high school, I would have felt way more comfortable and I wouldn't have felt the need to party as much to try to make friends, because I was like, okay, well, to make friends, I got to just party. I got to join a fraternity and I got to try to figure out a way to fit in. Because I didn't feel that secure. So if I was, you know, more secure and just felt more like I had gone to high school. And plus you only get to live one time, you know, going to high school is a very meaningful experience, I would imagine. So I think missing out on it, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but I probably should have gone.
Yeah, I think it's fair. But even looking at like my high school experience, because I went to just a public high school, is I was still, and I imagine it would have been the same for you, I was still traveling all the time, leaving school early for practice, tournaments on the weekends, away, missing homecoming, stuff like that. I went to prom, I did that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I still feel like I missed a lot of the high school experience because I wasn't, you know, on Friday night going to my friend's house and learning what a Smirnoff ice tastes like. So, you know, you miss that. And I think I still had the issue of like, you know, I didn't experience, you know, call it the drinking, call it the whatever in high school. And that came out more for me in college as well. in terms of just, you know, this is all brand new. I have independence. I'm going to go hard. And So I think regardless of, I think it's still a pretty, even if you would have gone knowing that you played a lot of juniors, I think it still would have been limiting, but probably certainly different.
Yeah, I think so too.
So you mentioned some stuff. Just want to get back to when you said, you know, you had 2 years on the Vandy team, then left or didn't leave. Well, we could talk about that transition going from on the team to just being a student and in a fraternity and getting kind of that full college experience, SEC experience, which also is pretty unique and fun, right? Being at a big, I wouldn't say a big school. It's one of the smaller schools in the SEC, but you get that kind of SEC college football type experience. What was kind of the impetus? What led to, you know, going from tennis to no tennis?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think me being homeschooled was a huge part of that, just because I felt like I didn't really get a lot out of my high school experience. I didn't have a ton of fun in high school. So I didn't really feel like I got a lot out of my high school experience. And when I got to college, I was definitely more focused on kind of making up for lost time and going out and having a lot of fun. And it's also Vandy is in Nashville and it is an awesome time. I would say I definitely have some regret about the fact that my tennis career ended 2 years early, but I mean, Vandy was definitely the best time I could have possibly had. My college experience was so fun and overall just so awesome and so meaningful to me. So I don't really feel like I missed out on anything now. I look back at my college experience and I'm like, I really did everything I could have possibly done. And being on the tennis team, I was there for 2 years and I was never really into it. I was in high school. I actually got to like number 5 in the country on tennis recruiting. When I was a sophomore, I was like top 5 and top 10 in the country in USTA all the way until the 18s. And when I was 17, I had ATP points in doubles, and these ATP points were had in the US. Like, it wasn't like I went to like, you know, some random country. Like, I was quite good when I was 17 or 16 even. And then from there, I just like got worse and worse and worse for the rest of my career. I just fell in love with things that weren't tennis. And by the time I was a freshman in college, I was just not that good at tennis. And I never even played for Vandy. So I was a guy that definitely should have played. I think, you know, I would have played if I took it seriously, but I just didn't. And sophomore year, I didn't play either. And I was like showing up late for team meetings, just doing all of the wrong things. And the coaches just didn't like me. I think they were disappointed in me. And looking back, well, it's funny because at the time I was like, you know, who cares? But looking back, I definitely understand because they had, you know, they believed in me. They put a lot into it. And I just did not pan out at all as a tennis player. And at that time, I didn't even know what working hard was. I didn't really know because I had never done it. And looking back, I did about everything I possibly could have done to not be good at tennis. So that is one of my regrets.
I was like, going to say with that aspect, like what was like when you were younger and when you were ranked that high in juniors, working your way towards presumably college and a college scholarship, was like, did you have kind of a goal at that point? Like, I want to play at a, you know, major D1 school and play number one on the team? Or was it just like, I'm pretty good at the sport, and it's come relatively easy, though I'm sure you've worked hard to get the reps like you have to. What was kind of the mentality, you know, as you were top 5 when you were 15, 16, 17? Like, what were your thoughts in terms of goals and aspirations with tennis?
Yeah, I always thought that I would be like top 100 ATP. And there was definitely some cognitive dissonance there. I mean, when I was 15, I think that was when I was at my best, relative to my age. So when I was 15, I actually won the 18 and under like Florida state championships for USTA in like the January version. And I beat like, you know, I was 15 years old and like in the semis, I beat a guy that was like a blue chip senior And in the finals, I beat a guy that was like top 10 in the senior class going to Columbia. And I was like, I was at the point where I was like, okay, you know, I played Kalamazoo. I think I got to the round of 16 and I was only 15. And I was like, I'm probably going to be, you know, top 100 ATP. That was just what I was thinking, right? I'm just a 15-year-old kid. Yep. I didn't really understand like the work that was needed. And it all came really, really easy to me when I was that age. And you don't really realize how easy things are coming to you if they always came that easy to you. And when I was 15, I looked like a slightly skinnier version of what I look right now. I stopped growing when I was 15. So I was 6'3", yeah, and I was actually pretty athletic. Like I was dunking a basketball when I was 15.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine like I was pretty good against other 15-year-olds in tennis. And then it just, I got worse. I think my best tennis was literally played when I was 15 or 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I think at that age, I definitely could have started for like many major D1 teams in tennis as like, I play like five or six. Yeah. And then by the time I got to college, I didn't. So it's interesting. And I think that I was thinking, look, I want to be a top 100 ATP tennis player. I thought I had all the tools to do it. And I don't even know. I think I actually might have. It's weird to say. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, I could have been top 100. But like looking at my trajectory when I was 15, I think if I did all the right things, and a lot of the kids that I was beating at that age ended up making it to like 200, even, you know, like I might even maybe some guys that got to like 100, which is interesting. And I'm not saying that I would have, but I think I could have maybe been in the conversation to be quite good. So that's what I was thinking at the time. And then it was weird. I got to 16 and I started liking girls, which was probably not good for me. And, you know, just wanting to have fun and go out. And I did find ways to go out and have fun. And I made friends. And when I was 17, 18, even though I was homeschooled, I had a good group of friends that went to real schools. And that wasn't good for me. And then that was pretty much it. By the time I was 18, like even going into Vandy, I was already checked out. I was like, look, I just want to have fun, maybe play some tennis, maybe not get good grades. I wanted to always get good grades because I wanted to get a good job after college. But outside of that, I was checked out of tennis.
If you could go back to that 15-year-old self who was obviously kind of, it sounds like, at the peak of, you know, tennis playing ability at the time, you know, relative to age, and you could tell him, if you give him a piece of advice and he would actually listen to you, what would you tell him?
Oh, you paused a little bit. Okay, there you are. I would tell him, don't change anything. I would say, don't change a single thing. Because which is funny, because when I was 18 or 19 or even 2 years ago, right before I started playing pickleball, I definitely had a ton of regret. And it's interesting because when you're 20 or 19, most 20 or 19 year olds don't live with like a ton of regret. Like you're almost too young to have so much regret. But for me, it was until I stopped tennis, I was being, you know, reintroduced to my regret every day because I would go out there and play tennis and I would play at a level that I knew was worse than I was 6 years ago when I was 15. Which hurts. Like you're going out there on the college tennis team and you're playing against guys who, when you were 15, 16, you would have destroyed them. I mean, I wouldn't have even probably played tennis at Vandy. I would have probably played somewhere like a better team even if I had stayed on the right track. And then I'm going out there and just literally I was like the 9th or 10th best player on the team. And there were 10 players. Like I was one of the worst players on the team. And it was just kind of, so it wasn't just like, oh, I could just push this regret away of not having made it. It was like every day I go out there and I'm like, my forehand, I'm just not who I used to be, which is such a weird thing when you're 20. You shouldn't really feel that way. So that was a lot of regret to live with, but I would tell myself to not change a single thing. And I'm glad, and it's actually kind of cool that that's the case now. And that's something that I feel very lucky and grateful to be able to say, because From 17 to 21, I just kind of thought, well, shoot, I'm just a loser. Like, I just messed up. I had a great chance. I messed up. And it wasn't like I was working every day to change it. I was actually just drinking all the time to forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, like there's two different things.
Yeah.
And I was just not good.
So you would tell him not to change a thing, but there's got to be something in that time period from call it 15 to now where you're like
I have a good answer.
Like little James, you know, maybe watch out for this, maybe watch out for that, maybe do this a little bit more, this a little less.
I have a good answer. I got you. So here's actually what I would. So I would actually say, I wouldn't even talk. I wouldn't say anything. And here's why. I have a good answer for you. The reason for that is I would not be here now if I didn't have those years of suffering and regret of having felt like I messed up so much, because I'm only working so hard now because I feel so grateful to have a second chance because I messed up. And I couldn't think of, truthfully, I wouldn't change anything because I made so many mistakes just, and really got to the point where I was like just doing nothing, to now every single thing, it actually like, I think permanently humbled me and permanently took away any sense of entitlement, because I realized that if I'm not working hard, I'm not happy and I just feel like I'm not doing anything. So now I feel so, I actually think I feel a lot more humble because I just feel so lucky that I even have the chance. Like, for example, I was just teaching a lesson and there's other guys that are in the top 10 that are like not teaching anything. And I'm like, well, I just feel grateful that I can even get out there and grind and work. And I think that once you get to that point of like rock bottom or close to it, and then you make it past it, at least for me, I felt like there's no way I'm going to go back and there's no way that I'm ever going to stop working hard just because I feel just lucky to even be in this situation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be doing myself justice as a interviewer here if I didn't ask you what that rock bottom is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was a mix of, I'll tell you that I was probably 205 pounds with like no muscle. Like I had a big gut. Yeah. And if you guys go back and look at my first pickleball tournament, even, which was APP South Carolina, I got bronze. I beat Zane, and I actually had a bit of a gut then. Like it was still kind of coming off. Like I wasn't in good shape at all. And I was just not even close to like being sober. I was going out like four nights a week. And I was just doing so many of the wrong things. I wasn't working out. I wasn't doing anything. And I was kind of just like during the day, just, and it's weird because I wasn't thinking so deeply about it, but I was during the day kind of just trying to get through it so that at night I could just like go out and just like drink or just do something that could distract me from the fact that I totally blew my chance of being successful. Because as a result of the, you know, the trouble that I got in college, also just getting kicked off the team and like some issues with classes and whatnot. Yeah, so getting kicked off the team, I was, it was in the middle of my sophomore year. I was showing up late for meetings. Like, and I was, you know, like even the night before matches, and this was like one of the main things, the night before a match, I actually got caught going out and drinking and partying until like 3 a.m. And our team had a match the next day at like 11. So that was kind of one of the final things that really did it. And I wasn't playing for the team anyway. So I think all of that stuff happening, I didn't really feel like I was going to get a good job even. I didn't feel like I was on the right track at all. So I was kind of just trying to forget all of that stuff. Instead of working hard to fix it, I just kind of turned to alcohol and turned to different like releases. And it was funny because I was in like the rock bottom point of my life, just drinking at like 4 p.m. and all of that stuff. And then I saw people playing pickleball. And at this point, this was 2 years or actually a year and a half after I got kicked off the team. So I came into pickleball horribly out of shape. I had not played any tennis. And I saw people playing pickleball. And the first time I played, it just felt like really, it was weird. It like felt really special. It kind of felt like I had a new chance to do something and maybe get good at something else. But most importantly, it just felt like I could not think while I did it. So I didn't have, it was like a, it was an escape. And it wasn't like I was, you know, using alcohol to escape. Well, actually, I was drinking and playing at first a lot. But I was, it was like an escape from my own thoughts and my own, like, just sadness, really, and just disappointment in myself. And I felt, for whatever reason, I could go out there and play, and like 2 hours would just go by like that. And I could just, you know, then afterwards, I'd go back to being, like, having some regret and stuff. And I might drink after, but at least I have two hours to play pickleball. And yeah, I wasn't trying to go pro right away. I didn't even know if there was pro pickleball. I was just playing at Delray Beach Tennis Center with, like, older people, trying to just escape my own reality and just kind of not think.
And you were finished with school at this point?
This was during my break from, this was during winter break from my junior year winter break. So we had a good month off. So this was in like late 2021.
And did you have any idea, obviously going into your senior year at Vandy, not playing tennis anymore, you find pickleball. Do you have any, and I don't think I did at this point in my life when I was, you know, going into my senior year or finishing my junior year, of, you know, what the future held, whether it would be a job, whether it be coaching tennis, whether it would be, I didn't know. Did you have any idea of what you were looking to do next, or was that part of the depression and feeling down on yourself?
All right, so now I'm here to talk to you guys about Selkirk backpacks. I probably shouldn't have to talk to you about them. I mean, you see them, you know, it's enough of an ad to see them at all these tournaments. I mean, it seems like everybody's got one, and I actually think they're the best. You know, I'm always begging Rob to send me more. I've got like four or five backpacks. They last so long too. I think the biggest thing about Selkirk backpacks is that they're really durable, especially with me. I mean, I'm putting as many paddles as possible in the backpacks. I've got gallons of coffee in the backpacks, sweaty shirts. I've done everything possible that you shouldn't do to a backpack, to a Selkirk backpack, and I've had it now for 2 years. So I'm a huge proponent of the Selkirk backpacks. I think the tour line ones especially are very good. They look cool. They look sleek. I personally like the black ones. I'm known to bring two of them on court every match. So yeah, these are just my personal opinions on the Selkirk backpacks. I also think the team line is good. And yeah, I think if you want one, get one, because they're going to last you quite a while. And they also look pretty cool. And they don't necessarily just look like a pickleball backpack either. I mean, I can wear them pretty much and bring them wherever, and it doesn't really, you know, it kind of just fits in with any other backpack that you would have. So
yeah, I had no idea what I was going to do next, because I had been like outside my whole life, and I really hated being inside and looking at a computer screen, and just knowing that I felt like I didn't have the work ethic to even have like a real good job. Like, you know, all my friends at Vandy were going to like banking or consulting or something. And I had like some academic issues also, like with some just like academic integrity stuff. And I really felt like it was going to be a problem for me to.
Was that cheating, or what yes. happened there?
Just cheating, copying off of a kid in class.
And at Vandy?
Yeah.
Got it. So how did that all play out? What happened in terms of kind of repercussions?
The repercussions were actually pretty minor. I got away with the first one. I knew that if I did it again, I would get in some big trouble. And the issue was that a lot of my good grades had come off of doing that, of cheating. So I kind of felt like I really had to dig in and kind of, it was interesting because I felt like now, okay, I have to dig in and actually do the right stuff and do the work. But I had so many gaps in my learning because I was just, and I'm not proud of it. I was being lazy. Yeah. So then I tried to enter other classes and I was like, I didn't even learn anything from the previous class that connected to this one. I'm screwed. And I really felt like I was actually screwed because Vandy is a tough school. Vandy's a good school. And I don't think I'm, you know, particularly bright, particularly good with numbers and stuff like that. So it was an uphill battle for sure.
A lot. So I've just seen in my own life that, you know, a lot of stuff in terms of like what I learned as a kid has kind of carried over into the way I've been as an adult, from from, you know, just kind of seeing parents, like my worldview as a kid kind of led to a lot of behavioral stuff going into high school, going into college, going into my adult life with everything that entails from jobs to relationships to everything. Based on kind of your experience up to this point, what are you, 24 now? 25? 23. I mean, you've lived a lot of life, it feels like, in a pretty short amount of time in those 23 years. Are you worried about anything that kind of that you've done in terms of behavioral patterns that might carry over to now or into the future? Like, is that stuff that you're aware of or thinking about and trying to actively change? Because a lot of it's just subconscious sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I think me getting good at pickleball... Well, I'll explain it this way. It was weird because I was not doing it to try to be a pro for the first, like, even almost year of it. I was just using it purely as, like, an escape from my own, like, bad thoughts and just wanting to, you know, just not good stuff. So I think that because it, you know, it turned into something where I was playing 2 or 3 hours a day, and then actually I ended up playing, like, 7 hours a day of pickleball. And it wasn't because I wanted to be a pro. It was because I was trying to just, you know, escape, which might, I don't know, it's weird. I guess that's not particularly healthy. So, and then by virtue of me just using this escape mechanism, I got really good. And I got good at it. And then I kept playing for so long. And I'm afraid, I guess, a bit that I have, like, I definitely have a very addictive personality. And I very much go all in on one thing. So I've got to make sure that I keep doing the right things and keep, you know, staying focused on things that are going to be good for my future, because I can just go completely all in on one thing. So I don't know. I think maybe, I don't think I'll get burned out, because I know I'm working really hard, obviously, and I'm working with just, like, you know, doing so many clinics and focusing on my newsletter and stuff, which I hope you'll let me plug at the end of this.
Of course.
But yeah, I think it's going to definitely be something where I want to be conscious of not burning myself out, but I don't really think I will get burned out, because I just know that with how low I was, I think that's actually almost like a burnout proof mechanism, because I am always going to be grateful from being so low. It's like, how could it get worse than that?
Yeah. So I want to touch again on just something you mentioned earlier, again, with kind of the transition at Vandy. And you mentioned that, you know, scholarship was gone. Family's in a financial position where they could keep sustaining you at Vandy, paying tuition, paying living expenses. You have their credit card. What do you feel? Do you feel like that was... And this is not like, I'm not a parent. I've never been a parent. I've never had something that I've raised that I love unconditionally. So I don't know. And this is no, like, indictment against anybody. Do you wish your parents hadn't paid for your tuition those following 2 years, or given you, like, what do you think? Do you think that would have helped in a sense of, like, you're on your own now, James?
Yeah, it's weird, because I'm super grateful for the fact that they did it, obviously. Like, if they hadn't, that would have been very tough. But, like, you've got to learn at some point. And I've spoken to them recently about it. It's like they were almost too nice of me, to me. I think because they were a little bit afraid of what would happen if they didn't, because they didn't really trust that I was even in the right headspace. So they were like, look, we got to just help this kid out. It was more of like a sympathy thing. Like, we got to just make sure he doesn't do anything bad.
Yeah.
So ultimately, maybe it was for the best that they did. I don't know what would have happened if they hadn't, but I think that overall they needed to, you know, maybe they needed to help me, but I think overall I definitely didn't learn. And that was why I kept getting in trouble, and I kept doing the wrong things, because they were too nice to me. And it's like, of course I'm happy they were nice, but I didn't learn. I didn't learn from my mistakes at all.
What do they think about everything that's happening now? Because you've had, I mean, call it a complete 180. It's you know, going from, you know, getting kicked off the team to not knowing what you're going to do next, to stumbling upon the sport of pickleball. what and to see where you've gone from that moment of, you know, using it as an escape and just kind of like a meditation or to
yep.
being one of the best pros in the world. Like, what's their take on all of this now with the kind of money right. that's in it now and what you're making? Like, are they just like, how did this happen?
Yeah. I mean, well, they are very happy, I think, because they know how much it means to me. And they know that, just like you said, I mean, pickleball was kind of just like a meditation for me. It was just a way to stop thinking. And I'm always, like, for the rest of my life, I'm going to be grateful to pickleball because it really saved me in so many ways. So that's one of the reasons why I love to teach, too, because I just feel so, and of course, like, the money is good, but I just feel, like, indebted to the sport, because if pickleball didn't exist, just like we discussed, like, I don't know what would be going on. I think they feel very, very grateful for pickleball. It's not even so that they're so proud of, like, you know, the money in it is great. And of course I'm happy about the money, but I think that their pickleball for the first year and a half was like, wow, I have something that I can do now that I like. You know, pickleball was the first thing I was like, wow, I like to do this. I'm actually having fun and enjoying the seconds that I am existing. So I just feel so grateful and so shocked that it's come this far. And that's why I know that I'm going to keep working hard and I'm going to keep grinding and I'm never really going to stop, because I owe pickleball is how I feel. And I owe it to myself to never stop. So I think that they've definitely developed a lot of trust in me, just knowing how much it means to me. And I think it's really, it's just crazy what pickleball has done for me. I couldn't be more grateful. I can't even really put it into words.
What was that moment of, because you said everything had really come easy. You never really had to work that hard. And you saw it kind of happen when you know, obviously, like, kind of when you hit your peak at 15 at tennis, it didn't sound like you kept having to work after that. And you saw the results kind of decline. When did that switch flip where you were like, you know, I know that working hard is going to help me be happy. And that's all I have to do to be happy and to feel fulfilled. Like, what was that?
Great question. So it was at first I started working maniacally hard because I found that pickleball was something that I actually enjoyed. And it's weird because if you aren't doing anything that you don't like, you know, when you're in college, for example, like I was, and you had everything so easy and you can just go do whatever, it rarely are you going to find that you become very happy and fulfilled with what you're doing. I think more often than not, you're going to find that you don't like anything anymore because there's no contrast and you're just like, this is just all lame. I don't have anything that I feel like I'm pushing towards and working towards and whatever. So anyway, with pickleball, I actually finally found something that I liked and felt fulfilled with and felt happy with. And I was like, okay, I need to get good, because if I can do this as a living, I'll actually be happy. So I started working maniacally hard and playing 7 hours a day, foam rolling and stretching, doing literally everything I could possibly do to have a chance to make this my job. And I never really thought I would make it as a pro. I mean, I even when I was like the singles, I was like, okay, I can make it in singles probably. So I was mostly just training singles because I never thought that I had the hands to play doubles or anything like that. Because in tennis doubles, I really wasn't that good. And I actually practiced with JW Johnson when I was like 7 or 8 months in. I didn't realize he was like the third best player in the world. I thought he was just a pro. And I was like, holy cow, like I'm never going to be that good. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I'll just be good at singles. But anyway, I was working so hard. And I really found that I, through that working hard of, you know, towards something that I was passionate about, I found some self-esteem. And I really found some sense that my own time was valuable again. And I think that's something that really, really can flip the switch. If you don't really have any interest in the value of your own time, that's a dark road to go down. But when I felt like, okay, this time, this hour, I could be getting better at pickleball and making a bright future for myself. That really, really is what changed things for me. I felt like every day meant something now. And I just got addicted to having that sense of meaning. So I kept working harder and harder and harder and just feeling like I, you know, my time mattered for the first time in a long time. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think one thing that a lot of people might not realize about you now, and it's one of the things that I appreciate so much about you and your journey and what you do, is that you teach a ton, you practice a ton, you it truly comes across that you love the sport. Like you said, there's a lot of guys in the top 10 who, you know, just play, just train, practice, don't teach at all. But you find joy in doing 3MEs and birding and lighting people up and getting their reactions from that, because they're having so much fun, right? They're like, oh my God, I get to see what this is actually like. And he's going hard. He's not just going through the motions in this hour that we have him. So I just think that's super cool. And again, it's like, it brings up this topic of you're very lucky in the sense that you found something that you love, that you want to work hard at. And it's this whole topic, which I don't know what the answer is for it, but it's in terms of what people do for a living. Like, do they do a job that they don't necessarily enjoy or like to make a living so they can do hobbies that they have a passion with? Or should people seek out work that they actually like, that's actually a passion of theirs, if that makes any sense? Because it's like, if everybody out there is searching to, let's say I'm a huge Atlanta Falcons fan, if I'm out there and I'm like, I love the Atlanta Falcons, that's my passion, how do I make a living off that? I mean, there's ways to do it, right? Like, I create like a store selling Falcon stuff, or I could create a podcast about the Falcons and get advertising, maybe, if I'm talented at it. But what are your thoughts around that? Because, and maybe you don't know, but I think all of us in pickleball, for example, the fact that we're having this conversation on a podcast and we can make money even doing that is insane to me and so cool. And we're so lucky. Do you have an opinion on kind of those two roads?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting, because for me, when I started really falling in love with pickleball and really working hard, it didn't really feel like it was work. It more just felt like this profound sense of like agency and meaning. But I also think that I was lucky, because I had I didn't have debt from student loans. And I also had I'm pretty like physically talented for pickleball. I got lucky in so many ways. So I think that, but I also think that if you really love something and you really find meaning in something, that you will outwork 99% of the people that don't love what they're doing. So, and that's probably most of the battle, you would think.
Yeah.
But then the other issue is, like me at that time before I found pickleball, there was nothing that I really was passionate about.
Yep.
So if you're not passionate about anything, then it's tough.
But I think that's a big piece of it, is people don't try new things very often, right? They're not out there exploring things that they might like. You know, they just kind of go through the motions and status quo. And I think that's a big piece of it, is go out and do different things. Go kayaking. Go, like, you wouldn't have known your passion was pickleball until you saw this little court and this little paddle and this wiffle ball, and you went out and hit it. And you're like, oh my God, this is sick. So I think that's a big piece, is people don't go out and do stuff.
It's weird. Yeah, I always feel, I'm always going to feel humble, because I don't feel, you know, like two nights ago, I actually had like a nightmare that this is so dumb, but like, you know how sometimes your dreams don't make sense? I had like the worst, and this is going to sound so stupid, but this is actually true. Like, I was literally crying. So I was crying two nights ago. I probably shouldn't even say this. I had a nightmare two nights ago that they canceled pickleball.
like the sport as a whole. Yeah.
Yeah. So stupid. And I was like, it was weird. But anyway, I just feel so like, I probably shouldn't have even said that. Somebody's going to comment like, oh, what a weirdo.
No, yeah, it's relatable. It's relatable for sure. I think, I think, yeah, if you're out there and you play the sport as a living, or make a living off of this sport, and you're not super grateful, then you don't deserve what you have.
I know. So I would say, yeah, to answer your previous question, I think try a bunch of things and find something that you're passionate about, because it's, I think one of the good things about living in the era now where there's the internet, you can find and try almost anything, which is such a blessing that people don't really think of. And if you find something you really like to do, it's not going to feel like work. And if you work that hard at it, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to carve out a living. But again, there's a lot of people with a lot of challenges that I never had to face. So yeah,
that's very fair. So we'll get close to wrapping it up here. So we've talked a lot about kind of what's led you to now, and kind of to close out this episode, I want to talk about what you're excited about, and what you want to change and what you want to see happen in the future here. So what is one thing that you would want to change about yourself in the next year?
Yeah. I think I would like to probably, I guess, get really accustomed to having attention on social media and having attention on Instagram and YouTube comments, because it's really a zero-sum game. It's not something that actually gives you any sort of long-term gratification. It really only leads to distraction. And I get a lot of this. It's all so fun for me because I never thought that I would have people that actually knew who I was, right? So it's not like I'm not like Jack Sock or something where like, no, now I'm playing pickleball. It's like I'm just a random guy. And now I've got a bunch of people who know who I am. And it's fun, but it's also, it's kind of like a double-edged sword, because it's not only just a distraction, but if you really care about your, like, you know, what other people think about you and all these people that are making comments, that can carry over to the court and it can make you play worse. And if you're out there in a big match and you're thinking, you know, what are people going to think if I lose or if I miss this drop? You know, people already say I miss too many drops, so I can't miss this next one. Then you miss it, right? Yeah. And it's just, so it's weird. I think if I would like to really just get accustomed to, you know, almost like numb to and all of that stuff and really focus. I think that's one of the things that that Colin's brother does very well. You know, he doesn't seem like he really cares. He doesn't really get nervous at all. He seems really just like, you know, and obviously I'm never going to have his temperament. I think we're so different, but I think just being really calm in those moments and just genuinely kind of saying, you know what, whatever, of course you care. Of course I care about like my fans and stuff, but like just really kind of just setting it aside, I think I would like to be able to do.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting battle in terms of where the sport is right now in terms of needing viewership as well. I totally get the social comments and stuff like that. Just think about like on-court temperament. I know for me, for example, like I'm very focused. I'm very serious. It's hard for me to crack a smile when I'm on court because I'm so kind of dialed and I want to win so badly. But at the same time, like there's a place for that. And again, that's my kind of default personality. That's just who I am. And that's, you know, do I wish I was more lighthearted and could joke with the crowd and could chirp and kind of get outside of my head?
Me too.
Yeah. Because I think it would be better for me as a person and would allow the, you know, fans to relate to me more. Whereas then I just look mad and serious all the time. They think I'm just probably an asshole, you know? So I wish I could do that. And I think they're, you know, I think it's still important for me, like when I play to try to bring some of that out just to, you know, just to have some kind of connection to the fans. And also I don't know if my default personality is the best way to be on court. I think maybe I'll play a little bit better if it's a little less serious sometimes. I haven't figured it out, but it is an interesting dynamic of competing really hard versus we need viewers, and to get viewers we need big personalities, and you do an incredible job in on-court interviews and allowing yourself to be super earnest and relatable and funny outside of the moment. But do you wish like in the moment that you could be Zhao Mei, who's just like smiling the whole time and like talking to the crowd?
Yeah, it's weird. It's funny because my on-court personality and my off-court personality are like so different. And I think that people don't really actually know me, which is interesting. Because like, of course I wish that when I was playing, I could be more like smiling and stuff, but I just don't play well.
Yeah.
I just did this exhibition in Miami. We were playing for nothing. It was like an MLP exhibition. I'm playing with Rob Cassidy against like Andre Daescu and Eric Lang. And I'm trying to joke around and I just can't, like, I don't play well. I need to be like, you know, just fully like meditative and just not even thinking and just so locked in. And I need to play with like an edge, but it's weird because then I have that constant edge and then I try to like joke around. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
So I definitely wish that I could be more like just smiling or like, I don't know, something. Because I look at myself on YouTube, I'm like, that guy's a bot. I literally look like a bot.
Yeah.
I play like a literal, like I'm AI, you know?
Yeah.
And like I watch, like, dude, like you see the, I hit that Sports Center shot, the tomahawk shot on Sports Center.
Yeah.
Everybody reacts. I'm just like stone face. Like, did you see that? Yeah, I didn't even realize what I did.
And it goes you're just like, it's a Tuesday or whatever.
Yeah, like I have no reaction to anything.
Yeah.
So I.
But what are you feeling?
Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, it's weird. Yeah, I'm literally like just dialed in, you know, and I'm not feeling anything. I'm just
you're
like,
thinking we won that point, next point.
Yeah. Yeah. So because I have to be that way because I have a history, obviously my thoughts run wild. So I need to be so not even giving my thoughts an inch.
Yeah, because if you do, it could just snowball and this thought leads to that thought and now you're just bouncing all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah. So I give up. I'm not even going to try to have a personality on the court.
Fair.
I give up. I'm just the coach.
So you mentioned some of the social stuff and like, yeah, people know who James Ignatowicz is now. And just as I said your name, can we set the record straight? It's Ignatowicz, correct? Am I saying that perfectly or no?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Ignatowicz.
So like it's is it ah or ah? Like Igna?
Ignatowicz, yeah.
Oh.
Ah.
The ah is brutal.
I don't care. I mean, it's better. Dude, it's either one is fine.
Yeah.
You know, as long as it's not
but
like
the proper is ah.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
it doesn't sound like you know, so I'm not going to listen to you. How do you say your name?
No, it's Ignatowicz. But the thing is, this is actually a fun fact. So my dad was adopted by Lithuanians, and they took that last name. But I'm not Lithuanian at all. I'm actually mostly Italian and like a little bit of like French and English or something. So I don't really even care. I mean, it's just
call me whatever. Yeah,
because I don't. I mean, you see a Lithuanian. I don't look Lithuanian at all. I look at
yeah. In terms of social comments, what are there any like brutally mean comments out there that like stuck with you?
That's a good one. Actually, this is not the issue for me. It's the positive comments that make me
lift you up of like, oh my God, this guy's a god type thing.
Yeah, or even just like just people are paying attention to me and expect good things out of me. I've never lived my life where people like expect me to do things well. You know, it's kind of weird. Even when I was good at tennis, there was like nobody who knew who I was. I was just a junior tennis player. The bad comments, I like them better because I also have no issue with them because I remember when I was younger or even when I was like 20, just messing around on Instagram and YouTube, just like being a troll, like leaving troll comments. Like I know what they're doing. They don't really hate me. They're just bored and they just want a reaction out of me or other people in the comments. Like I literally was that guy. I was a hater. I remember when I was 14, like on YouTube, some guy, like there was some YouTuber that was pretty famous and I just hated him. I just thought he was such a nerd and I just kept commenting. I was trying to get, all I was doing is trying to get him to respond.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, you're such a nerd. Like just really, I didn't actually care. It was more of like, I just wanted him to acknowledge me. So I really, when I see hate comments, it doesn't get to me at all because I was that guy.
Okay. So if we're doing this exact same conversation a year from now, we're both sitting here having a chat. What would need to happen over the next 12 months for you to be like, holy shit, that was the best year ever?
Yep. Great question. I've already thought about this. my newsletter, my coaching newsletter, would have at least 50,000 subscribers. So nothing insane. I mean, I know that I think the Kitchen and the Pickleball Clinic have like 100K or something like that. And they're not directly competitors of ours. They cover like a wide variety of topics. Mine is strictly for coaching. And I guess I'll go ahead and plug it. So I have this newsletter that is just for coaching. And it's just me. And then I've got two other great players that run it with me. We do like instructional videos. Like, you know, my hot take, for example, my last like hot take tip was that you should be making 9 out of 10 of your serves. And if you're making all 10 of those serves, you're not taking enough risk, you know, stuff like that. And then we do pro features. Like we had Anna featured on this one. We've got Tyra Black featured on the next one. And then Dylan Frazier featured on the following one. And we don't like feature and talk about their like lives. Like we know that you guys don't really care about like what I had for breakfast this morning.
Yeah.
We're just giving you advice on the game. So you can check that out. It's in my Instagram bio, or just, you know, if you Google James Gadowich newsletter, I'm sure you'll find it. Anyway, probably 50,000 subscribers there, which right now we have like 3,000. We just got our first one submitted, so we're not even really doing much yet. But that would be big for me. And the reason that that is the case, like I'm sure there's money to be made in a free coaching newsletter. We're all giving it for free. So like it's not going to be super lucrative for us, but really it is. And I tell this to other pros, especially like guys my age, and they don't believe me. They think I'm like BSing, but I really do like coaching, and I really feel so just like indebted to this game and what it's done for me. And I also feel like I am a pretty good coach, and I've seen all of the other stuff. Like I that's one of the issues with pickleball. There's so many coaches that just picked up a paddle 6 months ago and play tennis and don't know how to teach.
Yeah.
So I do feel like it matters, and I feel like it's helpful. So that's huge for me. If we had like a big coaching newsletter that really helped, then I could teach more clinics and really just help people get better. Like watching people, I know how much more fun pickleball became for me when I learned how to actually play and I got a good paddle and I learned like, and I just being able to give people that feeling is so much more valuable to me than anything. I mean, I want to be number one, obviously, but just knowing how cool that was to play this awesome game the right way. Like the fact that I could have like 50,000 people listening to what I'm saying and actually like taking my advice is just so, it's crazy for me to even think of. So that would be the main thing. And then I guess it also, if I got to like, even maybe just like consensus number two, I don't know if I'm ready to even say in the next 12 months that I would be number one in men's, but maybe like 12 months from now, I'm number one in mixed and I'm number two in men's. I think that would maybe be a little more of like a realistic goal that I think would be pretty cool.
Love it. What do you think is what's it going to take to bridge the gap from where you are to where you want to be in terms of the rankings or consensus?
Yeah. In men's, for me to be number two in men's, I think, well, shoot. I mean, Riley and JW aren't even playing PPAs probably, right? Like JW, Dylan. So I guess it's actually more realistic than I think. With those guys out of the equation, I would say that Riley and J-Dub are like the guys where I definitely feel like they're still better than me at men's on the left. But outside of those two, I think I'm right there. I mean, a guy like Andre, I think for me to be consensus number two in men's, even including JW and Riley, it would have to be just me playing a lot of men's, getting those high level reps, and then hitting a lot of drops, transitional shots. My transition and drops have come a long way.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch like my recent men's, it's like I'm actually getting to the kitchen pretty often. It's all reps. You know, it's not.
Yeah, especially from the back and the midcourt, it's all reps. It's literally just feel. And truly anybody can do it. It's just, who's going to put it, and it might take more reps for some people than others to get that feel, but literally to the tune of your coaching, it's like anybody can get good at drops or midcourt. It's just how long it's going to take and how many reps you're going to do it.
Exactly. And I think that for me, that's just something that's taking a little longer. And if you look at all like the legacy players, like Tyson, Riley, Ben, Colin, you know, they're all good in transition. Cause I think transition is the last thing that comes.
Yeah.
It just takes time. So I think that at the kitchen, I think they're, you know, maybe I am like very close to being number two. But I think that if I really dial that in, plus like hitting the big serves, I think that would be the main thing. Just transition, more out of the air attacks, getting better at attacking out of the air, and then just, you know, being willing to grind cross court, because I really can dink backhand cross with anybody.
Yep.
So especially as that shot's gotten better, switching to the power air, it's a little bit of a softer paddle. I don't need to force the issue so much off the bounce, speeding it up.
Yeah.
Really, what it's going to come down to is just playing a lot of high-level men's matches.
Yeah.
And figure it out on my own.
Yeah, I agree. Is there anything we haven't covered that you want to say before we close this out?
I don't think so. I already plugged my newsletter. That's all I need.
Well, I appreciate it. The guest for the new show, appreciate you, man. And
yep. For having me.
We'll see you. We'll see you a year from now where you're number two in men's and number one in mixed.
Yep. Hope so.
Thanks, James.
Hope so. Thank you.